Okay, well, I'm going to ask for you to be indulgent and patient with me because my notes are in French. So every once in a while I might have to find some words. The Confession of La Rochelle was written in 1559 at the first synod of the Reformed Churches of France. And by that year, the Reformed faith had made considerable progress in France. A large number of the nobility was coming to faith in Christ, and they were trying to put pressure on the kings. But the process started a long time before. One of the precursors of the Reformation in France is this person that you see on the screen here. I did not translate the slides into English, so you're going to have French titles. Jacques Lefebvre d'Etaples published at first he was a professor at the Sorbonne at the University of Paris, and he first published a lot on mathematics and on Aristotle, and then he turned toward biblical studies and dedicated the rest of his life to working in biblical studies. The first thing that he published was a book called the Psalterium Quincuplex. Here's the cover of that book, and here's what it looked like, at least one page here. What he did was publish different columns with different versions of the Psalter, of the song, the Book of Psalms, of course translated into Latin so that everybody could read it in those days. Following this, he translated the epistles of Paul after the Greek text and corrected the Vulgate, the Latin version. And he commented especially on the Book of Romans, and published, as you can see, in 1512, he published a Latin commentary on the Epistle to the Romans, in which he defends the authority of the Word of God and justification by faith. And this was done 5 years before Martin Luther. So he was really a precursor of the Reformation in France. He went on to publish more commentaries, especially on the epistles of Paul. And the commentary on the Epistle to the Romans was very popular. He published 7 editions between 1512 and 1532. So he was a great humanist, and went back to study the original text, which humanism taught these reformers to do.
Was Luther aware of him?
We don't know. We just don't know whether Luther was aware of him or not. Yeah. Bibles started to be printed in France, and the printers and the people who would carry the Bibles would be put to death because it was illegal to publish Bibles at the time. So, beginning in 1521, the Parliament of Paris began to put to death the people who were carrying books, Reformed books, evangelical books, and Bibles through France. Beginning in 1521. And the Sorbonne was behind all this. The Sorbonne was a Catholic theological school, and they did a lot of harm. Then Marguerite d'Angoulême here was a lady that had a lot of influence. Her maiden name was Louise de Savoie. She was married at 12 years to the Count of Angoulême and therefore became Marguerite d'Angoulême. Then she was widowed at 20 with two young children. The older child will become Marguerite de Navarre, and the youngest child will become the King Francis I. She had two regencies, as you can see there, in 1515 and 1525, 1526. She was a reformed believer, and later on she got married again and became Marguerite de Navarre. Jacques Lefebvre d'Étaples thanked the noble hearts and the Christian desires of the high and powerful ladies and princes of the kingdom for having helped him to print the New Testament. So these princesses were very, very important in the French Reformation. They were often converted, and then they helped the reformers. They protected the reformers. Marguerite later became, when she became the Queen of Navarre, had another child born in Saint-Germain in 1528. Her name was Jeanne d'Albret, and she became the Queen of the Kingdom of Béarn. The Kingdom of Béarn is down by the Pyrenees. It's now part of France, of course, but at the time it was an independent kingdom, and to its west was the Kingdom of Navarre. She was the first queen. She was the first queen in Europe to proclaim liberty of conscience in religious matters in her kingdom. Her son will become Henry IV, King of France. And she was the one who encouraged the French poet Clément Marot to write the Psalms in French rhymes. And we'll come to that in a little bit. So, these are very powerful people. One of the things that I've noticed in studying the Reformation was, we focus on people, but what was really behind the Reformation was the Spirit of God, because so many things were happening at the same time in many different countries. So, for example, Erasmus published the New Testament in Greek in 1516. Luther published the New Testament in German in 1522. Tyndale published the New Testament in English in 1525. Lefebvre published the Gospels in French in June of 1523, and then the Epistles in October and November of 1523. So you can see how within a few years of each other, the Bible is being translated into the common languages in many different countries. And the writings of Luther were available in France beginning in 1516 and were condemned by the Sorbonne. So it was illegal to have them or to read them. In 1532, Robert Estienne, who was 29 years old, published in Latin first at the head of a Bible, and then later translated it into French, what he called a summary of the writings, a summary of the scripture. And that was the first step toward a confession of faith. When you had reformers trying to summarize what the scripture taught, you're on your way to a confession of faith. Then there was another man named Guillaume Brissonnet, who was a bishop in the Catholic Church, but he became converted and became evangelical and began to protect and encourage the Reformation in a town called Meaux, which is just to the west of Paris. Now, he protected Lefebvre d'Étaples and allowed him to work first in Saint-Germain-des-Prés, then later in Meaux. And both of these men were protected by Marguerite d'Angoulême, whose portrait you saw earlier. Nevertheless, during these days, there were a lot of publications, and at the same time, there was a lot of persecution. As you can see in 1523, the year that that Lefebvre d'Étaples published his New Testament in French, the first martyr, Jean Vallière, is burnt in 1523, the same year, outside the Saint-Honoré gate in Paris at the pig market. And they chose the pig market very deliberately. Brissonnet, in 1525, the work of Brissonnet came to a conclusion. He was put on trial, and this is the account of his trial here, Le Procès de Guillaume Brissonnet. He was put on trial at the Parliament of Paris, so the Meaux group dispersed, and a few months later the Parliament forbade all translations of the scriptures into French. So that's why the publications had to be done outside the Kingdom of France from that point on. And the Reformers, however, did make... here's Clément Marot, the great French poet of the Renaissance, who translated 30 Psalms of David under the protection of Jean d'Albret. And here you can see the original, one of the original pages. If you can read French, and if you have strong eyes, you can see that the bottom text there is the beginning of the first psalm that he put into French rhyme. Théodore de Bèze was another great poet, and later, De Bèze and Marot would join together to finish the translation and putting into rhyme all 150 psalms. The book became known as the Genevan Psalter. And here is the first page of that book. But the Reformers did make some mistakes. You have it there on the... in 1534, you can see it on page 2 there. There's an account of an incident which is called in French l'affaire du placard. Placard in the 16th century French meant little posters. And this is the text. I'll read it to you in English. Two articles on the horrible, great, and intolerable abuses of the papal mass invented directly against the Lord's Supper of our Lord, the only mediator and only Savior, Jesus Christ. They put these little posters were printed in Switzerland, were imported into France, and overnight, on the night of October 17th to the 18th, hundreds of these little posters were put up all over Paris and all over a number of other cities. But the thing that really made this a mess was that they actually posted one in Amboise on the door of the king's bedroom. And Francis I, who had been raised by an evangelical mother and had an evangelical sister, as a result of that, became opposed to the Reformation. He considered that the Reform were not only heretics, but disturbers of the public order and guilty of lèse majesté. So that was one mistake. Another mistake was this. Yeah? an insult against the king, an attack on the king's person. Yeah. Another incident that happened in various places were these iconoclasts. They went to Roman Catholic churches and smashed windows and smashed sculptures and tore apart, you know, the art. Of course, Calvin and the great reformers were very opposed to this. And, you know, because if you want toleration, then you have to tolerate. And it was a grave mistake, and it helped to turn the king against them. Let me talk to you a little bit about Guillaume Farel. You know him as William Farel. On page 2, you have a number of things here. Farel was a very different kind of man than Lefebvre. Lefebvre was a scholar. Farel was not a scholar. Farel was born in the Dauphiné, which is in the foothills of the Alps. And he came from a common family. He had a strong temper, sometimes leading him to violence. But he was very energetic. He was born in 1489. And later on, when he was a student in Paris, he studied with Lefebvre. He was one of Lefebvre's disciples. He was converted around 1518 under the influence of Lefebvre. And by 1521, he renounced the Mass and turned away from the Catholic Church and began preaching. He accompanied Lefebvre to Meaux in 1523. And then when Brissonnet was put on trial in Paris, they had to flee. So he fled to Basel in Switzerland. And there he got to know Erasmus, and he got to know Œcolampadius, two great reformers. And he began to preach. In 1522, he began to preach. And as you can see on the sheet there, in 1525, he published in Italy, in Turin, in Italy, in French, a summary and brief declaration of certain theological points necessary to all Christians. Now, Farel was not a scholar. He wrote for the common people. At this point, many people were just beginning to read the Bible, and they needed some kind of guidance, and he sensed that. So he wrote this book. Another Frenchman, Lampère d'Avignon, published in Marburg in Germany, another Christian summary in French. By 1530, there were groups of believers in France who were getting together to read the scripture that was translated by Lefebvre and joining in prayer. And they circulated books very, very discreetly, because if they got caught, they could be put to death. But there were no Reformed churches at this point. By 1530, Marguerite de Navarre encouraged the poet Clément Marot to put the Psalms in French rhyme, and she protected him. By 1530, Neuchâtel in Switzerland becomes Reformed under the preaching of Farel. And as you can see, that year was a rich year. The Confession of Augsburg, written by Melanchthon, was published in Germany. And also the Tetrapolitan Confession by Martin Bucer, who was in Strasbourg. There were four city-states around there that were reformed and joined together. That's why it's called the Tetrapolitan Confession. And in Basel, 4 years later, Œcolampadius published a Confession of Faith. In 1535, you can see the publication of a Bible in French by Pierre Olivetan, who was a cousin of Jean Calvin. Of course, it was published outside of France. It was published in Neuchâtel in Switzerland. The translation was made from the Hebrew and Greek texts. And Theodore Thebes, in his History of the Reformed Church, writes, with the help of John Calvin, who went on to amend it further in a few places. In 1535, we have the first edition of Calvin's Institutes. But let me go back to Farel. Farel continued to preach. Neuchâtel became reformed under his preaching in 1530, and then Geneva in 1536. So Switzerland was a great place for people to publish literature in French and then sneak it into the Kingdom of France. Farel was also the author of a of another book. He wrote a number of different treatises that try to help people come to know the Scriptures. That's Farel there. I'm sorry, I should have showed you that portrait earlier. But he was the one, as you remember, who, when Calvin was traveling through Geneva, who stopped Calvin and asked him to stay in Geneva and help him to continue the Reformation. And you always see John Calvin as an old man. Here he is as a young man. Calvin was born on the 10th of July in 1509 in Noyon in Picardy. His father was a notaire, sort of a lawyer. And Calvin went on to study. He left Noyon and went to Paris and then to Orléans. At 23, he defended his doctoral thesis in law at Orléans. And in 1532, that was when he was 23 years old and defended his thesis. And Calvin was studious and timid. He did not appreciate being in public. He would have preferred to spend his whole life in his study, to write, to read, to reflect, and to lecture. But of course, God did not have that plan for Calvin. So at one point, when he was traveling, and he had to flee from France, of course, after his conversion. And he, when he wrote l'Institution Chrétienne, the Institutes, the first edition was in Latin, of course, because and this is he addressed the prefatory address to the King Francis I of France, who was the king that turned against the Reformation. And here's the text in English. Consequently, it seemed to me that I should be doing something worthwhile if I both gave instruction to them and made confession before you with the same work. From this, you may learn the nature of the doctrine against which those madmen burn with rage, who today disturb your realm with fire and sword. And indeed, I shall not fear to confess that here is contained almost the sum of that very doctrine which they shout must be punished by prison, exile, proscription, and fire, and be exterminated on land and sea. So when Calvin wrote the Institutes at first, it wasn't... it was an apology. It was a defense of the faith, and because he thought that it was very important to defend the faith before the king, so that maybe the king would relent and stop the persecution. He finished writing the Institutes in 1535. It was published in Basel in 1536. At the first edition had only six chapters, but he continued to develop the book The first edition had a chapter on the Ten Commandments, on the Apostles' Creed, on the Lord's Prayer, on the sacraments, and the first five chapters, some scholars think, were the origin of the Confession of Faith of the that became known as the La Rochelle Confession. I'm not convinced of that. The first French edition was published in 1541, and the last French edition was published in 1562. By that point, the the Institutes had grown to four books and 70 chapters. Calvin was 30 years old when he first wrote this Institute, and he was wise enough to know that he still had a lot to learn. And he studied with some of the great reformers like Ecolampadius, Bucer, and he worked with Farel very closely. In Geneva, in September 1536, Calvin started as a lecturer at the what would become the University of Geneva. His responsibility was to explain the scriptures, and so then he was called to the pastorate, but he was never ordained. Nor had he ever studied theology. He had studied law, and then he had learned theology on his own. He had never been a priest or a monk, as many of the reformers had been and were converted from Roman Catholicism. So he would recognize later on that he had an extraordinary call to the ministry. And he would argue later on that these kinds of calls must be absolutely exceptional. In 1537, Calvin published a book that is not called a catechism, but is called instruction in French, which was a word that was a lot easier to understand. And in this instruction, beginning was how to know God, the distinction between true and false religion. Then he had a section on the Ten Commandments, and a section on election and predestination. Again, a section on the Apostles' Creed. And justification, sanctification, penance, and hope. And then he had a section on the Lord's Prayer, explaining what prayer was about. Then a section on the sacraments, a section on pastors and their authority, and then finally a section on the civil magistrates. And 2 months after this instruction was published, he published also the Confession of Faith of Geneva. And the Confession of Faith of Geneva was something that the people of Geneva had to sign and agree to uphold. And preaching of Calvin, the preaching of Farel, was very popular in Geneva. But this Confession of Faith and having people sign it was not a popular movement. And it's as a result of that in 1538, the Civil Council of Geneva invited Calvin and Farel to get out of town within 3 days. And Calvin and Farel had resisted the move on the part of the civil authorities to forced the church to celebrate the Lord's Supper in the way that it was celebrated in Bern. And there was always a lot of hassle between Bern and the reformers. So Calvin and Farel had to leave Geneva. And Calvin at this point went to Basel and then to Strasbourg. Strasbourg had been an independent city since the 13th century, and it was a city that became reformed very early on. In 1525, a first group of French refugees arrived in Strasbourg, fleeing the persecution in France. And the civil authorities invited Calvin to set up a church for these French refugees. So in Calvin arrived in Strasbourg in 1538 when he was 29 years old, and his main mentor in Strasbourg was Martin Bucer, who was considerably older than him. He was 47 when Calvin was 29. And Calvin set up the first French Reformed Church, and it was done not in France but in Strasbourg. He preached. He wrote to Farrell and explained how they celebrated the Lord's Supper in Strasbourg according to the German-speaking church. They followed their practice, and they had the Lord's Supper once a month. Calvin would preach four times a week, and he taught his congregation to sing the Psalms. In 1538, Calvin sent to Farrell some of the Psalms that they were singing in Strasbourg so that Farrell could use them in Neuchâtel, where he was. And in 1539, as you can see on the sheet here, Calvin published in Strasbourg a book entitled, in French, the translation into English is A Few Psalms and Canticles. There were 18 psalms that he himself put into French verse and three canticles. The canticles would be the Magnificat, Simeon's Song, and another text taken from the New Testament. These were the things that they sang in Calvin's church. Now, Calvin was wise enough when he got back to Geneva to understand that Marot and De Bez were far better poets than he was. So he dropped project of putting the Psalms in rhymes and had these great Renaissance poets do it for him. And the church was blessed. But during this time, what was going on in France was persecution. As you can see here, one man is being led to be hung. There were all kinds of different types of persecutions. You know, people being burnt. You can see that guy is kneeling there. He's going to have his head knocked off by a sword. People are hanging from the under the archway there between the towers. There was just tremendous persecution in France. The Huguenot cross was a symbol that the French Reformed Protestants developed themselves. Under the cross there is a white dove representing the Holy Spirit coming down into the world. And the title up above says, Until Death. So by 1555, the Kingdom of France had five churches organized on the model of the churches in Geneva and in Strasbourg. And in 1559, when the first National Synod met in Paris, there were about 100 churches. And in 1562, at the beginning of the First Civil War, there were at least 2,150 churches. So you can see that there was an explosion of raising churches. You have to remember there were groups of people that were getting together to read the scriptures and to pray together, but they didn't have pastors. So once these people were together and they desired a pastor, often the pastors were sent from Geneva. Geneva trained hundreds of pastors and missionaries and sent them into France. And they all ministered at the risk of their lives, of course. But the church grew very quickly.
What happened in France that permitted these churches to be established?
A lot of it was done quietly.
So they were underground?
Yeah, very quietly. That's right.
The use of the cross, was that something that was worn or put on?
People identified themselves by means of this cross, and still do today in French Reformed churches.
They wear
the cross. Yeah, it's worn or it's put on the wall.
Okay.
Yeah. In 1555, De Bez writes in his book on the ecclesiastical history of the Reformed churches in the Kingdom of France. He said in 1555, Satan began truly to be assaulted and to be fought very close, much more violently than he had ever been before in France. That's because the churches were being raised and built up. There was a young man who came from the same region of as Calvin, whose name was Jean Le Masson, and these men often had a second name, a quiet name that they were known by, so that their families wouldn't be persecuted. He was known as La Rivière. He was the first pastor in Paris. And the way the church in Paris was organized was there was a gentleman, a noble, in the Saint-Germain, which was at that time just outside of Paris. And he desired to have a church there. He was Reformed. In fact, his wife had given birth to a son, and he wanted the son baptized, but he didn't want the son baptized in a Catholic church. So it became important for him, for them to find a pastor and to start a church. So they called this guy Jean Le Masson, and in 1555, the first Reformed church in Paris was set up with a few elders and some deacons and this pastor. And a few months later, in 1556, another pastor joined him, François de Morel, who was a noble from an area near Geneva in France. All these guys were trained in Geneva, of course. And later, François de Morel was very much in danger in Paris, so he was called back to Geneva, and then later came back to Paris. But there's another fellow who became very important in the French Reformation. His name is Antoine de Chandieu. He was a nobleman also, Sieur de la Roche. He was born in 1534. He was studying letters, literature, and studying law in Toulouse when he heard about Calvin. And he gathered together a few friends, and they were all around 20 years old, and they all went to Geneva to find out about this guy. And there, once in Geneva, they were all converted, and they started studying and being trained in theology there. So Antoine de Chandieu went back to Paris just about the time when the church was being established. And he was 22 years old, and he started to work with students. He started to lead Bible studies and prayer meetings with students. And then finally, when the church realized this guy's gifts, they called him to be a pastor also, to work with Morel and Masson de la Rivière. Now, Antoine de Chandieu was a different kind of guy. He was a very wealthy man. And he was also a poet. He was a very skilled writer. And these two men, Morel and Chandieu, are going to be very important in the organization of the church and also the organization of the First Synod of the Reformed Churches. Chandieu stayed in Paris for 10 years during a time where there was atrocious persecutions, 1557 to 1567. And he wrote the story of of this period, which De Bez calls the most bloody and murderous 10 years of the whole world history. In 1557, as you can see in on page 3 of your handouts, there was a meeting of around 400 Reformed believers in a private home on the street Saint-Jacques in Paris. And at that time, the Spanish army was working its way toward Paris. And the priests who were, the Rue Saint-Jacques was not far from the Sorbonne. And the priests of the Sorbonne came out into the community there and started a popular uprising. Now, the people of Paris at that time were armed. The government had armed them because they were expecting the Spaniards to invade Paris, and they wanted the people to help defend the city. So they had arms, and these priests provoked this popular uprising. These Reformed believers were worshiping together one evening. They celebrated the Lord's Supper. They prayed for the king. They prayed for the kingdom. And when they were done around midnight, there was a mob outside the house that was trying to get them. So there were a few nobles in the church who had swords. So they led the way and protected some of the people. So some of them were able to get out of the house and to flee. But there were more than 135 people that were captured that night. The civil magistrates arrived at during the early morning hours and saw that these people were doing nothing wrong except that they were evangelicals. The whole community around the house was in an uproar. People were throwing rocks at them. People were throwing, all kinds of arrows and things from their windows. They were just trying to kill these people. So about 135 of them were imprisoned. 7 of them were put to death by burning. And Chandieu wrote an apology to the king and a complaint to the king to try to help him to release the people who were imprisoned. Now, the word of this spread very quickly among the Protestant world, and Geneva sent De Bez and Farrell to the Protestant princes of Germany to ask them to send ambassadors to the court of France to convince the king, Henry II, to release these people who were in jail. And it worked. A lot of them were released. But you have to remember that these people were not just men, but women and children were captured and were thrown into jail under atrocious conditions. Here is the account of the first National Synod of the Reformed Churches of France, which took place in 1559. Chandieu, this is one of Chandieu's poems, which I'll translate for you. It's an ode on the miseries of the French churches. And he writes, "Memory, immortal memory, with my feeble voice I'm calling you, and between your hands I am placing so many past cruelties against your church, against the church exercise, so that you may remember them forever. Pull away from the forgetful silence, the impitoyable, how would you say that? The pitiless violence that went offensing and pursuing, which hunts and kills and breaks mine, my people, my church, and makes me die while living. It's one of his poems. He wrote many, many poems. Just wonderful poems. And he wrote this book too, Persecution and Martyrs of the Church of Paris from 1557 until the King Charles IX. The book is fascinating. He begins with an epistle to the reader that summarizes a lot of the persecution that we find in the church, in church history, beginning with the apostles and going forward. And he quotes a lot of the church fathers who wrote about their experience with persecution. And he tries to show to the readers that, in Jesus Christ, his people have suffered through the centuries, and that what's going on in France is not unusual. It's perhaps more severe at this point during this decade than it has been since the Roman times, but it's not an unusual thing. And then he goes on and he tells the story of the first martyrs of the church in Paris. He selects three people who were put to death from that Rue Saint-Jacques experience. One older man, one young man, and one young woman who was of nobility. Very skillfully written. And Théodore de Bèze, in his history of the Reformed Churches of France, takes this whole chunk of his book and reprints it. But Jean Dieu did more than that. This is the beginning. You can't read French, so Jean Dieu was very important in establishing the first synod of the Reformed churches in France. And if you're familiar with Paris at all, the big island there is the Île de la Cité. If you've ever been to Paris and you visited Notre-Dame is on that island. So is the Sainte-Chapelle and the Palais de Justice. And the place where the synod met is 4 Rue Visconti. It's now in the 6th arrondissement, which is the left bank of Paris, as you can see. Here's a close-up. It's right on that corner, Rue de Seine and Rue Visconti. You can see the point of the Île de la Cité right there. But in the 16th century, it was actually outside the walls of Paris. And they met there because there was a nobleman who had this house. On the corner of that street, and it had two doors, giving on one street and one giving on the other street, and it had a big garden, and it was just outside the city, so it was surrounded by fields, and they thought that perhaps if something went wrong, they could flee there. What the synod did, the synod met on the 25th of May in 1559, and they met in Paris, not because Paris was the more important church, but because the city was big enough that you could bring some ministers and elders and travel without being noticed so much as you would in a smaller town. So they met from the 25th to the 29th of May. The moderator of the synod was François de Morel, who was one of the Paris pastors. And the first thing they did was to establish what they call the discipline, which is a book of order for the church. And the book of order, the first paragraph in the book of order says that no church will have principality or domination on any other. The second paragraph says that the moderator of each synod will be elected by that synod, and his charge will end when the synod is over. And the third paragraph was that ministers will bring with them to the synod each one at least one elder or one deacon from their church, or several. So you can see the beginnings of a Presbyterian system being defined here. That was the first thing that they did. They adopted this book of order. And then they went ahead and adopted the Confession of Faith. And the Confession of Faith, they tried to get Calvin involved in writing the Confession of Faith. But Calvin thought it was a bad idea at that time. And he was also very sick during that year and was unable to travel. In fact, there's an interruption in his correspondence even for several months during that year of 1559. He was too weak to even write letters. He wasn't lecturing. People were just taking care of him because he was very, very sick. But he thought that the Paris church was moving ahead too quickly. And he didn't want to have anything to do with this project. So, you know, the story runs that Calvin was the author of the French Confession. But I'm persuaded by some reasonable scholarship that he was probably not. Of course, the institutes that he wrote highly affected the Confession of Faith. The theology of the Confession is no different than the theology of the institutes. And the Geneva Church did send two men to the synod in 1559, and these men arrived a little late. They arrived the last day of the synod, and they probably carried with them some kind of documents that were a contribution of the Geneva Church. But I think that the evidence shows that there was a synod of a local synod in 1557 in Poitiers, which is not too far from Paris, and they adopted a Confession of Faith, and it was their idea that was communicated to the church in Paris to set up a Confession of Faith for all the Reformed churches of France. And I suspect that they used that as a basis, and that Chandieu had a lot to do with writing the Confession of Faith. We don't know how many people were present for this synod. Yeah. Yeah.
So the Confession of Faith
was in
Westminster?
No, it was a century before the Westminster. Well, it's called the Confession of La Rochelle. It's also called the Gallican Confession. Yeah. We don't know how many members there were in this synod because we don't have an accurate account. And you can understand why they wouldn't keep an accurate record at the time because of the persecution that was going on. Some minutes, talk about a number of churches from Saint-Lô, Dieppe, Angers, Orléans, Tours, Poitiers, Sainte-Marène, Châtellerault, Saint-Jean d'Angély, and Paris. But often each church would represent a number of other churches in their area who, you know, couldn't send their pastor or couldn't send elders, but they were in unity. So each pastor represented several churches, and the most accurate count is that there were 72 churches represented in this first synod. There were no churches from the south of France represented, nor were there churches from the east of France, and that's because those areas of France did not have organized churches at this time. They had Bible study groups. Now, it was God's will that the synod meet, because during the synod, there was, they were burning people in Paris, just inside the walls there. And just a few weeks after the synod, the police came down on a Friday night to this place where they had met, because the noble who had this big house had a reputation of eating meat on days when it was prohibited. So about 40 sergeants and two or three commissaries surrounded the house and attacked it very rudely. There were about 15 people at the table eating dinner, and most of them were able to flee and run out through the fields and escape. But the police found the wife of the Viscount and his father and a number of his children, and they took them all away and put them in jail. And then this house served as a bit of a bed and breakfast for reformed people, and they found lists of people who belonged to the King of Navarre, who was reformed. And so they started looking around. They sent 400 or 500 men, some of them on horseback, all of them armed, and they started surrounding the house for 4 or 5 days, and they even went throughout the neighborhood, because that neighborhood had a reputation of shielding a number of reformed people. And you can imagine that this happened in June and July of 1559, and that synod ended on the 29th of May. So, certainly God had his hand on that synod, and his providential care of these ministers was very great. The churches were growing at that time, and there was a meeting of the king with the Parliament of Paris right around that period, that same period as well, on the 10th of June, 1559. And there was a fellow, one of the counselors who was in, you can see this on page 4 there, Anne Dubourg was a counselor at the Parliament of Paris, and he argued for toleration. And, the king wanted to squash the evangelical faith. And this was a little poem that was written about that scene, what was going on there in the parliament. The king was in the midst of his assembled court to give advice about religion, hoping that force and persecution would finally crush the gospel. And then Dubourg argued that all human force against God and his law would be nothing but vain. And for having well said it, they threw him in prison, giving force and not reason, glory. So he was imprisoned on the 10th of June, and he was held in prison until the 21st of December, when he was burnt alive. And here's a depiction of Andubul being burnt alive. So even within the Parliament of Paris, in the king's presence, you could not argue for toleration. You know, the king and the Parliament and the Sorbonne and the Roman Catholic prelates were all very powerfully opposed to the Reformed faith. And later, Chandieu wrote this book, which is a confirmation of the Book of Order of the Reformed Churches, because some Roman Catholic priests, when they got a hold of, you know, the Book of Order was published, of course, and they got a hold of it and they started arguing against the Book of Order, against the Reformed Churches. So he wrote this book to defend the Book of Order. And here's a first printing of the Confession of Faith made by common consent by the French men who desire to live according to the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. And that was the original title of the French Confession. In 1560, Chandieu wrote another epistle to the king to explain the Confession of Faith. And he entitled it, as you can see here, in the name of the French men who desire to live according to the purity of the gospel. And the official Confession of Faith that the Synod of Paris adopted had 40 articles, just as this one still does today. But there was another version with 35 articles that was published and circulated. And so that led to some confusion. And then in 1571, the synod met at the city of La Rochelle. And that's why the Synod of La Rochelle confirmed that the 40-article version was the Confession of Faith of the Reformed Churches. And that's why it's known as the Confession of La Rochelle today. But it was written many years before in Paris at that first synod. There were a number of other synods that met in Nîmes in 1572, Sainte-Foy in 1578, Vitré in 1583. And in 1583, the Confession of Faith of the Netherlands was brought by deputies from those churches who came to the French Synod. And they signed the French Confession of Faith, and the French minister signed the Confession of Faith of the Netherlands to prove that there is mutual conformity in doctrine and in good order. So we can see here how these confessions of faith were European in nature. The churches, the Reformed churches all over the European continent were you know, confessing the same faith, of course, which is the faith of the gospel. Let me. Here's the epistle of Chandieu to the king. And then Catherine de Médicis, the King Francis III, the second. I mean, this is on page 4. He reigned only for a year. He died sick. And Charles IX was just a boy at that time. So his mother, Catherine de Médicis, who was the wife of Henry II, had a regency for a period of 4 years, as you can see there. Now, Catherine de Medici was somebody who wanted to practice toleration, and she called for a colloquium that was organized at Poissy. And it was an attempt to have Catholic and Reformed theologians talk together. And there's an account of this colloquium in Debez's History of the French Church, if you're interested. I'm sure there's an English translation somewhere of this book. But they were just talking through each other. They weren't really listening. The French Catholics at that point understood that the Catholic Church needed to change. There was a lot of corruption. There were a lot of people who were making money off the church. Some of these things were brought up, but nothing happened. Debez was the one who was sent as the primary defender of the Reformed faith here. And he did a very skillful job. It's beautiful, the work that he did in defense of the faith. But they just weren't listening. And after the colloquium, the François de Guise, the de Guise family were arch Catholics, and they were interested in controlling the king. They were interested in, you know, all of these things were political things that were going on. And here's a stone that marks the place in a little town called Vassy, which is in Champagne to the east of Paris. And as you can see there, in 1562, François de Guise was just happening to go through that town on the 1st of March. And there was a group of Reformed believers who had gathered together in a barn in the town to worship together. And François de Guise, of course, was a military man, and he had his troops with him, and they surrounded the barn, and they killed about 250 people. Here's an illustration of what they did. As you can see, people trying to flee, even through the roof, trying to get out of there. And de Guise wanted to kill these Reformed people. And that set off a series of massacres, as you can see there, in Sens, in Tours, in the region of the Maine, in the region of Anjou. And that incident set off a series of civil wars, which... After this massacre at Vassy, Debez wrote to the king and presented this to the king. And he said to him, "Sire, the Church of God is an anvil on which many hammers will be broken." And that statement became an illustration, as you can see in his book. But it's also an illustration that the Huguenots have developed, and it's even published in the Confession of Faith of La Rochelle, that the church is that anvil. And if you look closely at the illustration, you'll see broken hammers on the floor, and around the illustration it says, "Plus ça me frappe en s'amuse, tant plus de marteau en use." The more you play hitting me, the more you will wear out your hammers. So Debez was just a brilliant diplomat. But then France entered a period of what they call the Wars of Religion, but they were really civil wars. They were noblemen against other noblemen, Reformed, Catholic, and they were fighting for power. They were fighting to control the king, They were fighting to control territory, and it was a miserable period. What was even more miserable was the massacre that came in 1572 on August 24th in Paris, the massacre of the St. Bartholomew's Day. This was many people were in Paris at that time to celebrate the wedding of Marguerite de Valois and Henry of Navarre, who would become the King of France. So there were lots of very important people, many noblemen, and the Guise started this fight again. They assassinated Coligny, and you can see, if you look in the chart there, 1562 to 1598, Louis de Condé and Gaspard de Coligny were the reformed leaders of the reformed army. Gaspard de Coligny was an admiral in the French Navy, and Louis de Condé was one of the princes. And then the clan of the Guise and the Duke of Anjou, the brother of King Charles IX, were the Catholic armies. So the Guise assassinated the Coligny, and this set off a massacre. There were 200 nobles killed along with Coligny who were in Paris for that wedding, and there were thousands of people. Between 2,000 and 3,000 reformed believers were killed during those couple of days. And there are many illustrations of this massacre because it was such an unbelievably violent period in Paris. And here is even in the apartment of the Queen of Navarre. They even went that far. Then Henry IV, who was the first of the Bourbon kings, he was raised as a Protestant in Navarre, in that kingdom, down by the Pyrenees. And he was very influential in defending the reformers. This is a declaration and protestation of the King of Navarre to justify when he had taken up arms in order to defend the Reformed churches of France. So this man became king. And of course, that didn't go over very well with the powerful Catholic nobles in France. And they resisted him. He became king in 1589, and he tried to unify the kingdom, but it didn't work. So he finally came to the conclusion that he had to become a Roman Catholic in order to unify the kingdom. And in 1593, on July 25th, he converted to Roman Catholicism. Now, one of the good things that he did was in 1598, on April 13th, he signed the Edict of Nantes, and here you have a picture of it. In the Edict of Nantes, the Reformed believers are granted the freedom to assemble to worship, but they have to do it outside the major cities, or they have to do it in the homes of Reformed nobility. But they were also given 1,000 locations for their worship, and they were given cities of refuge. I'll show you that on a map a little later. Here's the beginning of the Edict of Nantes. And then here, the Edict of Nantes is being registered at the Parliament of Paris. So even the Parliament of Paris had to agree with this because it was the king's edict. They had no choice. They had to tolerate. And here is a map of Protestant churches in France at the time when Henry IV signed the Edict of Nantes. As you can see, there were many, many churches. And here are the places of refuge in France. So if you were a Reformed believer and you were you know, your neighbors were starting to persecute you, you could flee to one of those towns and you would be safe there. Then Louis XIV, who was the who was known as the Sun King, he was the king who revoked the Edict of Nantes. He signed the Edict of Fontainebleau on October 18th, 1685, and revoked the Edict of Nantes. Not only did he revoke the Edict of Nantes, but he started severe persecution. The King Louis XIV wanted to get rid of all the French Protestants. And he had a group of soldiers called the Dragons, and he started what became called as the Dragonade in the Poitou region. He sent soldiers into Huguenot homes and encouraged them to debauchery. So they got involved in rapes and violence and drunkenness. They would take children away from these families and put them in convents or put them in Roman Catholic homes. And the only way that the family could get rid of these soldiers is if they would convert to Roman Catholicism. And this didn't happen here or there. It happened in tens of thousands of homes. Also, the king ordered Protestant church buildings to be torn down all over France. The Edict of Fontainebleau, which revoked the Edict of Nantes, outlawed Protestantism in France. Pastors had 2 weeks to either convert to Roman Catholicism or to leave the kingdom. If they left, they could not take their wives and they could not take their children under seven with them. The lay people were forbidden to leave the kingdom under penalty of death. But nevertheless, it's estimated that between 150,000 and 200,000 Huguenots left France between 1680 and 1700, of course, at the risk of their lives. They were, for the most part, young, educated, professional people. They were craftsmen. They were medical doctors, lawyers, accountants. And they went to England. They went to the Netherlands. They went to Germany. They went to the American colonies. The king forbade the Huguenots from going to Canada or to the French West Indies. And by the time the French Revolution came around, the king who was beheaded during the French Revolution understood that France needed some reforms. And he was a Christian. We have his prayer journals, and it's amazing what's in those journals.
Louis
XVI, that's right. And he had called for an Estates General to talk about these problems, but the revolution was a very anti-Christian movement, and they didn't wait to see what the king would do with the Estates General. They started the revolution. But one of the benefits of the French Revolution was that after the revolution, because the revolution was an entirely secular thing, French Protestants received all their civil rights. So they were able to assemble, they were able to live their lives as French Protestants. So here is about a century and a little bit more of the history of the Reformation in France. As you can see, God was very busy and so was Satan. And thanks for your attention. Do you have questions?
Yes. How did the Huguenots end up in Quebec?
Well, they ended up in Quebec very early. Very, very early. Quebec City was founded 400 years ago, and even before the founding of Quebec City, there were trading posts. A lot of them were established by Huguenot. That's right. In fact, 7 of the first, 11 governors of New France were Huguenot. It's very early, very, very early. But the persecution chased them over there. The Jesuits, when they got to Quebec, they enforced the same rules that were in France. So you could, you could have your churches, but you couldn't baptize, you couldn't bury the dead, you couldn't marry anybody, and you couldn't have any kind of synods.
You also mentioned Protestantism towards the end, and so when you're talking about Reformed believers, are they Protestant? Is it a Protestant Catholic conflict, or are you specifically singling out Reformed?
Well, most of the Protestant churches in France were Reformed. There were some Lutheran churches up near Germany. At first, the evangelical believers in France were called Lutherans, and then they called them Biblicists, Biblien, and then later they called them Huguenots, and we don't really know where that word comes from. It probably comes from the German, which they still use in Switzerland, in the German-speaking cantons, Eigenos, which means confederated. So they probably, that's where we think the word Huguenot comes from. It was a borrowed from, they looked to Switzerland, that was the country that was Protestant, and, they were aliens. So they used this word to label these French people.
So in persecuting Reformed believers, it's the persecution of the Protestantism, not just specifically Reformed theology.
No, it was the people who were persecuted.
Okay, so yes. And anyone believing in non-Catholic.
That's right. That's right. And that's why some of the Reformed believers, compromised. They would take part in the Catholic feasts. They would do things like that in order to be left alone. And Calvin wrote very powerfully against that approach to the gospel. Yeah.
So I mean, the 150 to 200,000 Huguenots left between 1680 and 1700. Did this result in kind of a brain drain on the country?
Absolutely.
How many people were living there at the time?
Yeah, absolutely. It was France was bled by that policy of Louis XIV. Very, very much. And of course, these people went on to contribute to the countries that they moved to. They went out and adopted, they took their skills with them, began businesses, and settled there.
I mentioned this to you before, but a lot of them came to the north of Ireland and they established the Irish linen industry. Irish linen was not Irish. They blended into the Protestant population.
Were the Jesuits formed specifically to persecute the Protestants?
I don't know. We
know they did do that, though.
Yeah.
When they made.
There, looking back in hindsight, there are some historians today that write about that time in France, and they say that the biggest mistake that the Huguenots made was to take up arms. But the situation was very different then. France was not a united kingdom. There were, depending on which nobleman you were with, he could have had a mighty army that could challenge the king's army. So there was a lot of power play in all that, and religion got mixed in with the power play. So it's very hard to, it was a very different situation, and it's hard to look back today and say, yeah, they should have put down their swords and just,
But how predominant was that, Pastor? Were they, in all of your explanation, that's only mentioned once, that they took up arms?
Well, the princes and the nobles took up arms very often. Even Henry the Fourth, because before he became king of France, when he was king of Navarre, defended the church, and they often, you know, took up arms.
So even the rank and file.
Yeah, the big events were between 1562 and 1598, what they call the Wars of Religion. Now, it was not an ongoing war. You know, there was a war, then they'd establish some kind of a peace, and then things would start again. There were, I think, 9 episodes during those years. But you have to remember that oftentimes it was the people that would take up arms, just like that incident in the Rue Saint-Jacques in Paris in 1557, where the priest stirred up the neighborhood, and then, I mean, it was bizarre because the Spanish army was coming, but the Spanish army was Catholic. So what would these people have to do with, you know, supporting the Spanish army? Very strange. Minji?
How does the confession compare to the witnesses? Did it have any influence?
I don't know if it had any influence on it. It's a lot briefer. It's very carefully written, and it's a wonderful confession of faith. But I think the Westminster Confession covers a lot more than the Confession of La Rochelle. And the Confession of La Rochelle begins with God. It doesn't begin with Scripture. It begins with God and His revelation. And then it has a section on man and his sin, a section on Jesus Christ, a section on the work of salvation, a section on the church, its nature, then the church, its organization, then the sacraments, and then the final section is on civil power. And if the king ever read this confession, he would see that the French Reformed people were not rebels. You know, they were not revolutionaries. They, the two paragraphs under the civil authorities are entitled "The Necessity for Government" and "The Obedience That Is Due to the Authorities." But I don't think they ever bothered to read this. Any other questions?
Tom and Brian.
Oh. Just to comment that something I learned several years ago, Peter Fangio, Fangio Hall for the city, was a Huguenot.
Was he?
Yeah.
Uh huh.
And then French.
So the way the handout, it looks like, you know, God, you know, we go through all this pain and martyrdom and work for Reformation. And then at the end, everyone leaves. So, how many were left? Did, I mean, 150 to 200,000 Huguenots leave in a few decades. Is there, how many were there?
I don't know. I can't give you a number. Okay. But there were some who didn't flee, of course. And some of them fled to Strasbourg, fled to Geneva as well, years before that. You know, because they saw this coming,
and
they just left so that they could go on and worship and teach their children the gospel.
Start that side, come in, and then they leave.
What's that?
Start that side, the friends come in, and then they leave.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it left a very small presence. Mm-hmm.
It left a small presence, but in the south of France became very Protestant, very Reformed, and they went through a period where they called the les églises du désert, the churches in the wilderness. And if you ever go down to southern France, There's a wonderful museum that's worth visiting, the Museum of the Protestant Churches. And they did, you know, they gathered together for worship, but they gathered together out in the countryside. They gathered together, they had ministers. They still had ministers.
Are those the sins of the desert?
Huh?
Are those the sins of the desert?
Yeah, that's right.
Christian, there's a book about a French Protestant village in South France, in the which was part of which of course is the Vichy part of France in World War II, where the whole village, led by the French Protestant pastor, sheltered Jews.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're familiar with the story.
Yeah, I know the story.
That's a published, yeah. Yeah,
so, you know, the Reformed faith didn't disappear from France. It stayed there. In fact, the south of France at one point had political assemblies. They were actually considering separating themselves from the Kingdom of France. That didn't work out. But they wanted to set up a Huguenot state.
Can you remind me in what context you gave this lecture?
Well, the context was the church in the Reformed Church in Quebec City worked with the one of the museums in Quebec City. That's a museum of civilization of French America, it's called. During the 400th anniversary, to set up an exhibit on the Huguenots of Forgotten Presence, because most Quebecois have no idea that you know, the Huguenots were there, that the country started out Protestant and Catholic, because the Catholic Church became so powerful in Quebec until the 1960s. So they worked with the museum, and interesting enough, I saw the exhibit when I was there in February. A lot of the material that they had on exhibit came from the Catholic seminary archives that they had put them away so that they weren't public. So they dug these things out, and they were often big books with holes in the middle so you could hide a Bible, or little tiny psalters that women could hide in their hair, or mirrors with crossed backs so you could put a Bible behind the back. It was all stuff like that, you know. So it was in that context. What they did was they set up a conference to teach the faith of the Huguenot. And so I gave this historical lecture. It was a little bit more articulate in French, of course. and then the next day, I took them through the Confession of Faith. And I can't do that with you because I don't have an English translation. Any other questions?
Okay.
Thanks for your attention.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.